Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 9th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is our presenter, Dorothy Bass. Today's session is titled, The Opening, the Gift of Time. Let's listen to Dorothy.
My name is Dorothy Bass, and I come here from Valparaiso University, and this is a session on time. I've called it Opening the Gift of Time. Yesterday's session was time in turmoil. And just so we'll be really open to thinking of time as a gift, let's just for a minute revisit the turmoil, because I hope that today we can move beyond that into some of the Christian practices that can help us to perceive time as a gift of God and to think of it and perhaps live in it differently than many of us do now. As I mentioned, I started thinking about time a few years ago when I was part of a group of people, many of whom have taught at Holden, that together wrote a book called Practicing Our Faith, which was last year's theme book at Holden. I'm the editor of this book, but it was very much collaborative among the 13 of us. And as I said, many of whom have taught at Holden. It's always embarrassing to plug a book that has one's own name on the cover, but it's in the Holden bookstore, and they just want me to let you know that it's there. Well, in this project, part of our presupposition was that the spiritual hunger that is so manifest in our society now is partly, at least, a hunger for a way of life that adds up to something, a way of life that is in some full sense good for ourselves and for other people, for creation, a way of life that is informed by and part of God's life. But that's part of what we hunger for when we think of the spiritual hunger that's abroad in our land. And this group of people wanted to suggest the contours of a way of life, being very much aware that it's different in every social context, in every cultural context. But still, there are some, we can find some guidance in Christian faith, as it has been worked out in very practical situations over the centuries, that if we're creative and insightful, we can appropriate for the sake of building up a way of life that is good in our own age. But we did this by setting forth 12 what we call practices of the Christian life. Hospitality, forgiveness, healing, dying well, honoring the body. And one of them was called Keeping Sabbath. And I wrote that chapter because, as soon as we knew that was going to be one of the chapters, I just knew I had to write it. Because I'm a working mother. We have 13-year-old twins. My husband works. Life is very busy. Life is very full. And we are among the many, many people, single, married, whatever, who feel that time is just kind of pulling at us. And that our days can become very fragmented and that can kind of blow away in the midst of obligations. Someone will come up to me and say, "How was your day?" And I just can't even remember, it's like that. So I thought this is something I needed to think about, Sabbath. And I did, Sabbath as one day a week, which is set apart for rest and worship and renewal, which we will talk about in very practical terms in a little while. But in talking with other groups around the churches, and in fact, a lot of newspaper reporters have seen this and have called me up to ask about Sabbath keeping, because it's such a hunger for people to find some way to order and to rest their time. But Sabbath is not all that our faith has to say about time. What about days other than Sabbath? What about the shape of our year? What about if you can't keep a Sunday Sabbath? What about? Okay, there's lots of practical and other concerns besides Sabbath keeping that come to us when we think about getting time in order in our lives. And so I've been thinking about that now for a few years, and this fall a book will be published called Receiving the Day, Christian Practices for Opening the Gift of Time. Now, with that background, let me try to invite you into this thinking, which is very difficult in our present day context, to think about how we could resist dehumanizing patterns of time that are in our culture. In the same way that at Holden we so often talk about resisting dehumanizing patterns of consumption that are in our culture. We talk about that a lot. But is there some relationship between those, and how can we resist some of the dehumanizing patterns of time? Okay, what are some of the problems with time? This is what we did yesterday. Some of the reasons that time seems to be out of kilter and so problematic for us. One, I mean, many people will say, there's just not enough of it. You know, there's too little time to do all the things that I feel like I need to do. Does that ring true for anybody? Yeah. Even up at a retreat center in the mountains, right, Jeff?
Yeah.
People at home talk about being too busy, even in the winter, you know. So too little time is an experience. And there are sociological proofs that your perceptions that you have too little time are correct. Okay, so to do the things that most people need to do. Another one, though, I think is really, really worth thinking about is that time is losing its shape and its form. Think about the global marketplace that is made possible by the World Wide Web. Okay? Go into a college dormitory, and you know, they're all up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Maybe that's always been true, but then, you know, talking to friends at distant places. But that may be a great thing, but you can shop at all hours, you know, which is another spur to consumerism and throws a lot of people's body clocks off. You can have entertainment at all hours. Do you remember when TV went off at a certain, anybody old enough to remember that? You know, it's just there's very, less and less is there really a difference between night and day. Okay? What about days of the week? Okay, Sunday is now more like all the other days. Right? And if you think about it, nature doesn't give us weeks, right? I mean, they are really arbitrarily imposed. You don't have to stop counting days after 7 and then start the day name again, over, okay? But that's cult. So nature does, it's not embedded in nature. It used to be embedded in culture. Now it's, you know, the global marketplace doesn't seem to have much sense of different days of the week. Years, even. Okay? There's been a lot of published about people taking their laptop computers along a vacation. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Taking cell phones along a vacation. Right? Never a stop for certain people. Right? Similarly, we can get fruit and food up from all the seasons, in any season. Right? I mean, you go into a grocery store and they make it their policy. They want to have whatever it is in all seasons of the year. And often this is at the price of justice to workers and the destruction of local economies for the sake of these cash crops to keep us in season all the time, summer, winter. The other thing is, you know, on the Christian calendar there are feasts and fasts, right? There are times of lull and times of celebration. And it's a wonderful op-ed article I saw last Christmas. You know, we're always feasting. How can we, what's special about Christmas, you know? And, you know, the way in which the seasons are shaped by commerce has now become part of that. So the sense of time that is, the sense of differentiation, boundaries on time, is part of the technological and social and cultural backdrop against which time seems like such a problem for us. Okay? There aren't boundaries, there aren't. So now they're going to open the stock market at night and so on. So the very busy, you know, have this problem. On the other hand, we need to note that there are many people whose time is considered not to be of value, right? The permanently unemployed, permanently underemployed, sometimes people whose retirement has come too soon or in too isolating a fashion. Not all retired people feel that way. Sometimes people whose abilities may not be the same as others. Now, so there are people whose time is not valued. There are others. Part of it, I think, is this American and modern sense of time is money. Time is money. Which we can think about. Okay, and that may be the third problem. Our assumptions stifle our imagination. That's one of the other things we talked about. Ways of seeing time that help us, keep us from thinking about it in fresh ways. Time is one, money is one of those. Time always divided into little hours of the clock. Okay, the dominance of the clock in our consciousness and in our lives. Okay. Clocks, I told this story yesterday, clocks were invented in monasteries to call people to prayer. And in that context, they sounded out a reminder of God's eternity, our mortality. Okay. But Benedictines wanted to keep up prayer all constantly, and so they had the hours that chimed. But when you take a clock and you put it on the tower of a factory, and you make sure that everybody has the exact same clock in their own home, set to exact same time, okay, you can start counting hours in a different way. Hours used to be, until about 300 years ago, hours were 1/12 the time between dawn and dusk. So they'd be longer in the summer, shorter in the winter, longer in the south, shorter in the north. That doesn't work when you're paying people by the hour, right? So this whole sense of time as clock determined, anthropologists have other ways of thinking about time, event time, okay? So these are very, very much embedded in our mind. So I think that partly because of these assumptions, other assumptions, good people use time a certain way, bad people waste time, I mean, deep stuff that gets to guilt and shame and condemnation of one another around time, right? The more that I think about this, the more I think that, you know, time management or finding the right date book or finding the right computer software that will get everything into order. You know, if I could just get everything done once, start fresh, then I'd be okay. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it's a bigger problem than that. Since most people weren't here yesterday, we tell a story about how in fourth grade, my kids, one high school town, Indiana, were required to buy a date book. Very much, does this happen to your kids also? Yeah, very, not just a little Hallmark greeting card thing to keep track of your friends' birthdays, but a date book with, you know, week at a glance, with little boxes for all the things they were supposed to do. Yes, this happens in other school systems. That's what I've learned. Isn't that something? I mean, what are we saying to our kids? That their time is going to be squeezed out of them, that every moment that they have will be put to use. That's one thing that we're saying. Another thing, though, is think about that as an image of what time is. That here I am the master standing above time, which is flat and in boxes, and my purpose now is to put the right things in those boxes, you know, fill them up in such a way that I'll have a happy life, right? I'm above time, looking at it as a number of units, which then I can use in certain ways. And if I'm important, I'll get a great big calendar, and if I'm wise, I'll mark out times for my exercise and my devotions, right? But in fact, we don't live above time, we live in time, right? We're not above it, we're not masters of it, we're within it. It flows over us in a certain image from future to past without our mastery. It is a given, it comes in 24-hour chunks, you know, which are given to us by nature in the turning of the earth and in orbits of the earth of a year. Right? It's a given. And also in the length of a life whose duration we do not know in advance. And is created by God along with everything else. I referred this morning in Matins to the hymn of creation that begins Genesis. and it was evening and it was morning the first day. That's the creation of time, right? In that day. And it's on that that everything else will be, all the blessings of history will be hung, on that creation of time. So, time as a given, time as a gift. Time management, I would submit, is important. I have nothing against, you know, trying to organize things so that we get done what we want to do and so on. But I think that the level of angst, shame, mutual condemnation, fear, pain that many people experience around time will not be solved by any date book and calls for other kinds of measures. And in particular, it seems to me that over the centuries, and embedded in biblical tradition as well, there are ways in which the Christian community has come to remind itself, taught us to remind ourselves of the gift quality of time. Okay? And the gift quality of all the things that we encounter in time, which means one another, that which sustains our material needs, and so on. That's kind of a summary from yesterday, okay? And today I want to talk about what some of those practices are by which we can remind ourselves of the gift quality of time, and I think therein find some of the spiritual strength it will take to resist the dehumanizing structures of time as they exist in our society. That's my basic analysis of the situation. Let me take the comments or questions. Is this ringing true, or am I overstating the case? Is time a problem?
I think that there's a popular belief that if you have free time, you're unproductive, and you're supposed to fill it all up with something.
Yeah.
And if you're sitting around enjoying something, that's not right.
Right.
I guess I'm thinking of professional workplace and also schools,
right,
of most
schools,
levels.
Yes.
But also the workplace, too.
Mm-hmm. In fact, school is one of the main places where we get socialized into the culture, the dominant culture of time, isn't it? And in Chicago, in whose media orbit I live, the inner city children who really have the most trouble in school are the ones who haven't been socialized into time. Time is so basic in any way, in any shared community, any shared pursuit, Holden, anywhere else. But you're right, there's a condemnation, isn't there? There's a works righteousness, in Lutheran terms. Yeah, about time. It's a commodity to be used, and you're not a good person if you don't use it right.
And if you're not using if you have leisure time, then you're supposed to be doing something really serious with it. And you're supposed to be doing some, equipment-laden activity like kayaking or something,
right,
that you have to buy a lot of things for. And you have to do this with your time, or you have to do some serious working out. But
right,
sort of sitting around and being with your own thoughts is not.
That's an interesting phrase in the language of an overworked people. There's a book called The Overworked American that really, working out is what we now do with our time off, right? That's a great language thing, yeah. Anybody else? Yes,
I guess I have a counter view.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are ways in which society works to steal time from us that isn't free or work time. I have a big problem at our house getting the television shut off.
Okay.
It's a constant struggle.
Uh-huh.
So I know why schools give calendars to students, because you got to point out to the kids how much time they're spending in front of TV. And also I think that society says, well, your commuting time is, you have to do that, right? And I think that's not free and not useful either.
Right.
So I think that it's not just a matter of free time versus work ethic. There's also the time that is robbed.
Great. Systemically, practically, and with economic structures and with cultural attitudes.
I was thinking too, when you were saying the same thing, and we were talking about people having blocking out time for devotions and for exercise. Mm-hmm. But my experience is a lot of people who don't do that, that time is taken away from you. Right. So it's almost time management becomes almost a defensive mechanism because the demands of your job, of your family, of your community will absorb that time if you don't take some for yourself and for what's really important.
Yeah, and I think that's really really helpful. No, I think that's really helpful.
If you don't do it.
Right. No, and I think that's really helpful. I would want to, I'm going to try to assume some of that into a Christian practice of you know, clearing the space to receive the gifts of God. And we come to the same practical conclusion, but not as a matter of mastery and defense, but as a clearing of the space for receiving and honoring the body, which is which is God-given.
I certainly wouldn't say that I think it's a positive thing that you have to manage your time.
It's
a defense mechanism. It's become reality in society.
Right. I think it's an important technique. Also reframe attitudes as well. Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
I just had to remember that I've heard somebody say that we've sort of put time in a place of an enemy, that we that we kill time. We try to steal a minute. Time robs us of something else that we should have. And so we sort of put time in this extra place in our life that almost gets too many negative kind of
things. No, that's very helpful. Yeah. We also talk about saving it as if it were something that needed to be ransomed from hell or something. You know, I mean, really kind of it's a religious image as well as a banking image. Yeah. Over here, yes.
Getting back to children for a moment, I teach school in Palo Alto, which is where Stanford is, and it's a very high-powered community. And kids are robbed nowadays, especially in communities like that. I don't know how it is all over, but they're really robbed of their time. They're scheduled for classes and play dates, and you know, everything's scheduled for them, and there's I see it all the time where there's very little time just to go out and play, just to play and be a kid. It's really sad.
Right. Yes. Thanks.
Yesterday afternoon, having come to your class yesterday morning, I'm more aware, I heard a father here telling his son to hurry up, come on, and the little kid says, why? And he says, because you're wasting time.
I think I'm writing a book about this. I have such trouble with it in my, you know, in my own family, because it's so much the way I was raised.
Oh, yeah.
And I do want them to be productive people, my kids. You know, I really do. But
they need to be kids.
Yes.
And I think as a parent, we also use time sometimes as a punishment. You know, I'm going to give you time out.
Right. No, that's fine.
I'm going to take away time from you, and you're going to sit there for your punishment is 5 minutes of your, you know, time out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
And that's a new sort of 90s phrase.
Right.
Well.
Right. It is. Thanks. Did somebody else?
I was just going to say that, you know, because of the busyness and the pressure to always, you know, be accomplishing something, I think that we're really unfamiliar with things like sitting quietly together with our family or sitting quietly by ourselves and thinking or not thinking. And so it's so unfamiliar to us that it's somewhat uncomfortable. And when those opportunities come along, we think, I've got to go do something. Something's happening. There's always something on the to-do list.
Yes. Great. Well, that's great. Now, let me use that as a segue. I mean, haven't we been habituated, in a sense, to busyness, to noise? I mean, we find at the university, people, students have to always have music going while they study. And I couldn't study with music on, but, you know, there's just always something. And so that we become uncomfortable. But it's a lifelong habit. We've been practicing for this way of life, you know, since we were born, since somebody gave us a date book in fourth grade or something, right? We've done lots of practicing for it, and we've gotten good at it. Well, you know, we've also been practicing at consumerism, right? We get good at that. We could practice at overeating. We get good at, you know, eating the wrong things. We're good at that. We practice, you know, you build up whatever it is. Well, we talk a lot at Holden about finding forms of resistance. How do we get into other kinds of habits, other kinds of of ways of living that will be more true to who we are as people created in the image of God. And I think we need to do that with time as much as with other things. And moreover, I think that for people who are parts of Christian congregations anyway, we have a start on it. We have a start on it in little things like bedtime prayers with our kids or on our own. And we have a start on it with going to church. We have a start on it. But it needs to spread out from that place of worship and, you know, figure out what that means in the rest of our lives. Okay? Can I lead you into this? I'd like to have us look at a scripture passage just briefly. If you don't have a Bible, I don't think it's a problem. It's going to be a familiar one. Exodus 16. Now, I've been at lots of Bible studies at Holden over the years on Exodus 16. This is a story that is set about 2 months after the Exodus. We're in the early part of the wandering in the wilderness. Okay? Would somebody the first 8 verses is what we're going to want. Some volunteers?
I'll read it.
Jeff, thanks.
The first 8 verses?
Mm-hmm.
The whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elim, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they had departed from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. And that way I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. On the 6th day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and your fill of bread in the morning, because the Lord has heard the complaining that you utter against him, what are we? Your complaining is not against us, but against the Lord."
Okay. This story continues through the chapter, getting no elaboration. But it's a familiar story, the story of manna. God fulfills this promise, right? Now, in one sense, it's a story about food, right? That God provides an amount.
God.
God's abundance is not a feast, but it's enough, right? Can you hoard it? You can't hoard it, right? You gather too much, it'll rot, right? And this goes on for, the people eat manna for what? 40 years, right? While they get into a new habit. And for they're learning to trust God, right? They're going to bed every night hoping there's some the next morning, but there's none left from today. Right? They're learning to trust God. And I think in the Exodus story, this passage through the wilderness, including the manna, is a story about they're being prepared to live as free people after being slaves. They're becoming God's people. They're taking on the law. Right? This is before the Ten Commandments in the story. Okay. Do you see also it might be a story about time? Sorry about time as well. And what part does the rhythm of time play in their preparation for freedom? Since they're saying at the beginning, they're saying, "Give it to us right now."
Right.
Any thoughts about
it's a daily thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
It's not something.
You can't hoard up your trust.
You
can't control it. You can't hoard up your trust in God either. I mean, every morning and every evening, you're going to have occasion to say thank you, right? And to be surprised by the newness of what God is providing. What about the sixth day part?
No. Yeah. It clearly says to rest on the seventh.
Mm-hmm. Right. Rest on the sixth day. It'll be a double supply, so that you'll rest on the seventh. Right. And this is even before the people being prepared for this. Even before Moses received the Sabbath commandment. Okay. In the narrative. Right. In a sense, they're not only are they going to rest from work on that seventh day, but when they go to bed on Thursday night. No, Friday night, so you know, Friday night on the night of the sixth day. They're resting from worry. I mean, they already have the food in the store, you know, in the storehouse for the next day. Right? There's a sense in which learning to live by God's time patterns is also part of their preparation for freedom. I would just use that as an image of the kind of habituation for freedom that they are. That they're experiencing. Any other thoughts on that? See what I mean about the, you know, and I think that if we're going to get into some better habits or form, you know, resistance for freedom in the some of these problems are just going to be getting worse and worse about the lack of differentiation between different times. And so, okay. The tendency to take work on vacation, and so on. They're going to be getting worse. So how do we start to habituate ourselves to live as free people within this, what can be a very dehumanizing situation? And let's start with Sabbath. I'm going to leave time also to do everyday practices, but let's start with the idea of Sabbath, okay? Brief theological introduction, which I spell out in Practicing Our Faith and also in the new book. Do you know that in, I won't take time to look at this, trust me, Exodus 20, Moses is going to get the commandments. The commandment that I think Lutherans call the third, I grew up calling the fourth, is that right? Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Because on the seventh day, God had finished the work of creation and rested and hallowed the Sabbath day. Okay, do you remember that? In Deuteronomy, it said, Deuteronomy 5, the Ten Commandments are given again. This happens. Moses is looking back on the Exodus and telling the story again. And it says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, because the Lord your God led you out from the house of bondage, and therefore you shall keep the Sabbath day. It's the only commandment that differs significantly between the two renderings. Okay? Same commandment, don't work, and don't let anyone in your household work, and don't let the foreigners who are visiting you from other lands work, and don't let your animals work, and don't let your servants work. Okay. Because God led you out of slavery. What's the connection there? That when you keep Sabbath, you will be remembering that you were led out from slavery. Slaves can't take a day off. Slaves cannot take a day off. Free people can. So to take a day off integrates you into that Exodus identity of freedom.
Okay. And responsibility.
Okay. In what sense? Same word, but.
In that we don't really choose so much to sleep at night to renew ourselves and replenish ourselves. Because our bodies just give in.
Right.
But it's a choice, a deliberate, intentional choice to go to the to that larger cycle of the week and take the seventh day off and rest and renew for that next cycle.
Right. Okay. That's great. Thank you.
That's God giving us time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when you're slaves, you don't have, the one thing you do not have is time, therefore you do not have freedom.
Right, right.
So God is, in my eyes, is saying, I'm giving you time, and what you do with it, I'm going to give you guidance.
Uh-huh.
As a slave, you don't have the option at all.
Right, right. Okay, that's great. Other thoughts? There are people who are economically enslaved today who are not able to take a day off. Okay. There are also people who are enslaved to their own importance and to their own
workaholism.
And I I've been through that myself, and but it is now there's. I heard a wonderful homily about this, and they said, but, if I just can't get it done, that someone said, well, whoever, show me someone who can't get their work done in 7 days, and I'll show you someone who can't get their work done in 6 days, which is kind of a stewardship motif. You'll have people say, well, yeah, I can't tithe, I don't have enough money. Well, if you can't live on 90% of your income, you probably can't live on 100% of your income, right? We use that metaphor. So there's a liberation motif, I think, behind Sabbath keeping, which I would then extend out to make it a day when we practice special concern for those who are in slavery of various kinds. Okay. Secondly, as I mentioned, the Exodus 20 version of the commandment is, you should not work because God who created heaven and earth finished work on the sixth day and set the seventh aside. Now there's a kind of a creation motif for Sabbath keeping, right? That when we rest, when we observe the Sabbath, we are recognizing that God created the world, not we. Valuing the world as God's gift and experiencing ourselves also as creature, coexisting with creation, which God made, okay? Now, in Judaism, one of the central ways of understanding what the Sabbath is to say it's a day when humans do not alter the natural world. That's why very observant Jews will not light a match, okay? Or do work of that sort. Anything that alters a piece of wood. And over the years, I've come to see that, in a sense, the human race is on the earth all the time, tilling it, burning it, tearing it up, reaping, cutting things down, carrying things around from here to there. And that the Sabbath reminds us of the wholeness of this creation within which we live. Okay, that's a Jewish interpretation. Yes?
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking that it also reminds me of the concept of that God created us in his image and for us to reflect that by doing what God did.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Did you get that?
No.
I just said that if we choose to honor the Sabbath as a day of rest, it's honoring also the concept that God created us in his image, and so we reflect that by doing what he did, resting on the seventh day.
Mm-hmm. In the image of God.
Yeah.
But not God.
Right.
Right? So both of those are there, which is great. I want to suggest that when we keep Sabbath and in whatever kind of complex ways we can come up with, which is what we'll get to, that we are living out these beliefs and making them stronger within us. We do believe that God created the world, not we, more fully. No, we do believe that we're free, not slaves, more fully.
Mm-hmm. That's about the same thing in God. Saw it was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And this gives us a chance to realize all our blessings and the world that God has created for us.
Yes.
Specifically.
Yes. Pause for thanks and to notice it as gift. Right. The gift of time and also the awareness of all the other gifts that time bears. Okay. Thanks. Now, These are themes. In fact, you could say that these themes of creation and Exodus are the strongest themes of the Old Testament. You practically have Old Testament theology right there, creation and Exodus. there's some other things too. But, and in fact, in Judaism, you know, Sabbath is almost a beginning point of observance. More than the Sabbath has kept the Jews, more than the Jews have kept the Sabbath has kept the Jews. It forms identity. Well, as Christians, we're in a different kind of circumstance, and different theology begins to emerge as well. Okay, and in the early church, the very earliest church, of course, Christians were Jews who went to synagogue on the seventh day, who kept Sabbath, and then the next day, to remember the resurrection, ate together and experienced again the presence of the risen Christ. So, you know, every shall we say, first day since 30 AD or something, the Common Era, Christians have eaten together and remembered the risen Christ and celebrated again the resurrection. And but caught up in that Sunday celebration also is a sense of resurrection as new creation and as a new exodus, a new kind of freedom. Okay, so I think that for me, theologically, I think that moving the observance to Sunday, which is finally what happened in, after centuries of Christian history and complicated separations from the Jews, that we can claim the Sabbath tradition on Sunday, as most Christians have done, but add to it the celebration of new life, of the victory of life over death, which is celebrated in weekly, in the weekly celebration of the resurrection. Okay? We do that liturgically, don't we? In church with the Eucharist on Sunday is a it's a foretaste. It's both a recollection of Jesus' resurrection and a foreshadowing, a foretaste, an experience of the end of time when we'll be united with God in the great feast. And it's also us right here, right now. Right? So there are these three, there's liberation, creation, and resurrection, I'd say, is undergirding a theology of what I still would call Sabbath keeping as a practice for understanding what time is and who we are within it and seeing it as gift. Now, has anybody been trying to think about Sunday in a special way in your own lives? I mean, you have.
I'd like to share. I found an interesting when I really started to really intentionally observe Sabbath that it became so embedded in my being that even when I thought, oh, I'm going to have a great Sabbath day, I never did. It just becomes such a cycle that somehow, and it's very easy to keep, I find.
Okay. I don't find it that easy always, but, you know, I do think that there's a central gift here for us. And so let's start with this. I'll leave time for other things also again. And talk about what kind of things would we do and not do on Sunday in order to claim this gift of time. One more point. Some spirituality writers talk about Sabbath as Sabbath time, which can come in little pieces all through the week, or, you know, you go on vacation, have a good Sabbath. I don't do that. I think it's out of keeping with the deepest wisdom of the tradition, and that the tradition wants us to have. In the biblical theology and the whole tradition of the church commands to us a day, but that there are other practices for yearly refreshment and for daily refreshment. So when we keep the word Sabbath for a day a week, okay, which I think normatively for Christians is Sunday, but I'll, you know, in difficult circumstances, I will be flexible about that. So, and the reason I wanted you to think about liberation, creation, and resurrection is I think there are clues in that theologically to what one does and doesn't do. Go ahead.
I'll share anything that I define as work. Anything that I define as I have to do, that does not exist on Sunday.
And what would some of those things be?
Oh, my business, or actually lately though, I have to admit, it used to be housework, and I'm so busy that sometimes actually polishing something in the house on Sunday is a delight to me because I don't have that kind of time the rest of the week to do that. So it's actually, so it sort of shifts depending upon where I am in my life, but it's really any path to like are shopping, avoiding shopping, avoiding television. Those are not have to's, but just sort of also avoiding the media and kind of consumerism.
Okay. Yes.
I remember reading a book, I think it was autobiography, of someone whose family kept strict Sabbath when she was a child. And she was talking about how she came to enjoy that day so much because it was a day when she...
It's a real stress, and I'm trying to figure it out, but I haven't found some answers.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe Sabbath has to be a moving time, and you need to read what it is. And sometimes it's probably on Saturday night and Sunday, but it really means finding that time that you need for rejuvenation or whatever.
I want to share all of the pastors and employed staff at our church. Their Sabbath is not Saturday or Sunday because that is the intense time, worship in the church, but they all stagger through the week a Sabbath day for themselves. So it might be Monday or Thursday or Wednesday, but they all choose a day that's their Sabbath.
What about pastor spouses and families?
But then you get the same day off. That's a problem.
I work for a church as well, and I have the same problem that it is work during the week, and then when the Sabbath comes, it is work. But with the people that I work with, we tend to, and this sounds terrible, but almost as soon as church is over, that begins our kind of Sabbath. It's a different type of Sabbath because when you're embedded in it the whole week and you have church on Sunday, you have to shut it off a little bit. And that's the switch that when you take off your vestment, whatever, that is going to be the time that you start your Sabbath.
Okay.
It is no longer work.
Great. Now, does anybody have church meetings on Sunday afternoons?
We do, but I'm getting it sometimes.
Okay. Why are you against it?
Because it's work again. In my opinion, it's not enjoyment time. It's not a time that I can rest my brain. I have to think, and I don't like doing that on a Sabbath.
Any other views on that, or...?
Well, sometimes there are even services like Sunday evening or something.
Well, that's it. Services seem a little different to me than the business meeting kind of thing, where the annual meeting where we'll get in and fight about money, on a Sunday afternoon draft.
How important is it to have a 24-hour Sabbath period? Is it possible to do sort of half of Saturday, half of Sunday? Does that work? Do people... What do you find from your experience? Does it have to be a 24-hour
Let's ask that question. Thanks.
Block of time?
My experience is the more you can get, the better. But in this modern world, demands that we have on us, I have certainly found it very difficult to achieve that. I mean, I'm lucky if I can get a weekend that I feel like I've really had to be on my own. So, that's my perspective, is you kind of have to take it, the way you can carve it out.
I think that the idea of a generous time, as opposed to a little...
Exactly 24 hours.
Yes, I think that's what's key. For me as a teacher, it was a real breakthrough for me when the passage I read in Matins this morning about days beginning in the dusk. Well, this made a lot of things possible because then I could count Saturday night and I could get back to work on Sunday night, which I just couldn't go to teach on Monday morning and not have Sunday night. And this just freed me up tremendously to do it that way. Yes?
I'm thinking of exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Because I found that I'll try to take the Sunday until dusk. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
But I do have to start working to get ready for the work week. And having that sense, you sort of made it legitimate for me.
Well, I think it is legitimate. And there's some other very reputable theological defenses of something besides Sunday, which I'll share in a minute. Okay, yeah.
Well, I was just thinking that just now that there is kind of this conflict within a family. I mean, traditionally, it used to be the whole family had this set Sabbath time, Sunday.
Right.
But it doesn't sound like that works for people. Well, is Sabbath just an individual's thing, or is it a family thing?
Right.
I mean, how can you work that out?
Right, and then what about single people also?
Yeah.
I mean, family, I feel like our family will be getting somewhere when we can say we go to church because that's the kind of family we are. Rather, when we stop saying that and we start saying we're the kind of family we are because we go to church. You know, I mean, there's a different prioritizing there.
I'm just saying,
yeah,
figuring
right,
out
right.
the timing of all of this.
Right. No, it is.
If you are in a family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. But I mean, aren't there, don't we resist all kinds of things as families together? Or do we just, you know, when do we cave, when do we not cave? That's, you know, yes.
You know, my question is, what do you do about Sunday afternoon soccer games and music mm-hmm. recitals? And, I mean, you look at it, it's something I enjoy. Mm-hmm. It actually is something I enjoy, mm-hmm. but it's busy. It's like you're always going, trying to get someplace. Yeah, so
right.
that, to me, is...
That's what a society kind of dictates.
It is.
I'm mm-hmm. really amazed exactly. in my town that they hockey is really big with the kids, and they have hockey, you know, during Sunday school and church, uh-huh. and there are kids that skip, you know, because of their hockey practice and their games, they skip Sunday school and church. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what all the, you know, this is another thing that parents contend with is
but even Sunday afternoon.
Let me make a suggestion. I mean, what I think playing is great on Sunday, on the Sabbath, as part of Sabbath. Playing, I mean, parents standing around watching kids play ball, this is great. The problem comes when it gets so much into, you know, fundraising, driving across the state, you know, really competitive stuff. I mean, it might mean just that we talk about, in sessions talking about creating a local currency, well, you know, about a local co-ed, not so competitive soccer team, you know, that doesn't, that where the parents agree on a meeting time. I know that happens in our town. I mean, there are prudential judgments. I don't think there are laws here, but choices that need to be made. Does anybody have good suggestions or choices? Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I have suggestions, but I've been thinking while we've been talking mm-hmm. about choosing a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And the question to you is, have you looked at the Shaker mm-hmm. model of lifestyle and time?
Well, you know, I haven't looked at that one, but there's always, they're kind of a American, Christian, but sectarian, utopian community that withdrew, as if you would go up to Holden Village and try to have as little few guests as possible, right? Or like a monastery. I admire that very much, but I guess I think that the calling of most of us is to try to figure how to integrate this into our lives in the world.
Yeah. What's interesting is most of us look at our watch and we look at our watch to see what time it is not, rather than what time it is.
Uh-huh. Say more about that.
Well, you know, uh-huh. I'm always in a hurry. Uh-huh. I've got to be there at 12,
yeah.
so I'm not in the present
right.
thinking about
mm-hmm. right.
what's going to happen mm-hmm. in the future.
Right, 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 mm-hmm. right. Now, for people who work at churches, in a sense, you are keeping Sabbath on behalf of others. I mean, it's like a healing ministry. You know, it's kind of like Jesus healing on the Sabbath. I mean, you're serving your neighbor so that the neighbor may keep Sabbath. You know, and the neighbor in a good Christian community should make sure that you get some too. You know, at some point, Jürgen Moltmann, a very eminent German theologian, argues that we should. Have both that the Sabbath is really we need to stay with the Jewish Sabbath, and that's the day of rest. And then there's the Sunday celebration. That seems a little more than probably I want to even propose in the modern situation. But on the other hand, there is then that option, you know, of a Saturday as part of the whole weekly observance. A wonderful Orthodox theologian, Alexander Schmemann, points out that in the early church, the first day of the week, the day of celebration, was a working day. It was the first business working day of the week. And so Christians went to church through the hustle and bustle, okay? Which suggests to me Monday as a day of celebration. In other words, you can kind of I think you can kind of stretch these things, but what I'm after is a weekly day that is somehow linked to a remembrance and anticipation of resurrection, that remembers creation and liberation as part of its purpose, but that they can, you know, they can stretch the boundaries some. Does that seem?
Well, if you're talking about choices with the soccer games, and we've been through that, and we observe that too now, even though our kids are older, and it is really countercultural. Mm-hmm. So it takes some scary kind of choices, you know. I mean, with kids too, who are faced with being part of the culture.
Right.
I mean, I'm just going to give one example of the kind of pressures, you know, everybody faces, but we had a trip that was planned for a business trip where we were all expected to leave on the day before Easter Sunday and not you know, be working. It was a trip to Japan, so the whole team was expected to go on to Japan and be there for a week. I said I wasn't going to go. I mean, I did not go on the trip. But, you know, the response I got is some of the people said, well, that's fine, we understand. There were a different religion. So they said, well, this is your Christian holiday, we understand, well, because we're Jewish, whatever. But, you know, the fact that I had to push back like that,
right,
it was, you know, and maybe I can do that this time, but the fact that the company is making those kinds of choices, making us make those kinds of choices.
Yeah. That's tough. The kind of the situation of religious diversity is an important one here. In one sense, it makes it much more difficult for Christians, at least, to be lazy about it, right? I mean, in the olden days, they wouldn't have scheduled those things on Sunday, and because we were in cultural hegemony, and it was easier. But
I do.
But now they do. But I think, but in a sense, it's then the accommodation of the Christian community, which still sees itself as in a majority, that's part of the reason that it's hard for us to resist. I mean, there are, you know, a Jewish Sabbath keeper, I think, now can get a lot of respect because of the clarity and the conviction that goes with that. And if we join our desire for observance and celebration of holidays and of Sabbath with respect for those of others, and recognize that we're a minority doing this in a countercultural kind of way. I think that's a different kind of approach than being mad that the society doesn't run on Christian time anymore.
No, exactly. Yeah. I think what it told me is if I had said nothing, I would have just gone along and made that sacrifice. By pushing back and saying, look, this is a major holiday, this is very important, I'm religious, and saying that straight out, people have to respect that, and they have to accommodate it, and they can't hold that against them.
Right.
I hope not.
Yeah.
If they do, then that's just the way it's got to be.
But they can hold it against them.
Yes, they can.
Right. But that's,
we hope they don't, but they really can.
Right. Well, they can hold a lot of other things against
you too.
So. No, really,
but
you know,
there are
that have to do.
That you just have to say that's the way I live my life.
Now, I mean, part of my hope with all this in proposing is not just to get a rest, you know, but to grow stronger as people who know and embody certain truths about what creation is and who made it, okay? What God intends for people regarding liberation and freedom as opposed to slavery, you know, and what is stronger than the power of death. That life is stronger than the power of death. That the point of it needs to be growing in those directions and not simply getting a day off, right? And I think that in that sense that the patterns of time in our lives then are reframed. We're kind of, in a sense, on a Sabbath, practicing a different kind of behavior as if we were out there getting manna. You know, practicing a different kind of behavior that can help us to be more free, more creation-oriented, and more confident in the power of life over death than we would otherwise be. I think that's the kind of the point of it, I think there are certain things we also do in the course of a year. as Christian people that integrate us into God's life and story, okay? And that the church should be proclaiming what those things are. I mean, seasons and festivals and fasts. This whole story of death and resurrection, okay? That the church can be proclaiming these as meaningful forms of time over against the undifferentiated kind of time in which the culture is living. Okay? And there are ways of welcoming each day and acknowledging our limitations and immortality in the evening when we sleep that are also, can kind of put down anchors amidst this great internet soup of time that where otherwise we'll be bobbing along like little ships with no rudders, you know, doing whatever the time people, the time gurus tell us to do, right? And never feeling like we do that in God's keeping or as people who are graced with something besides date books. Okay. So, this is just a little taste and I need to let you go, but that's all I have to say, and I think we need to end at 11:45. So, thank you. I'll hang around for a few minutes if you'd like.
Well, I'm just thinking of Brother Lawrence and the underlying...